From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear the voices of people who participated in yesterday's protests, plus learn about the history of Milwaukee's civil rights protests and the relationship between the city's police and our Black community. Then we learn how the current recession and our political tensions have made economic mobility harder than ever.
If you're listening to this, you're probably not going to become a billionaire. You just had no chances of being a billionaire before this, and you certainly don't have any chances of being one after. The only thing I'm going to do is make you feel slightly better about that reality.
Plus, since schools closed in March, educators and students have been trying to figure out their new normal.
You know, home is usually your respite away from school. Like, you come home and you kind of have some downtime, and it's like you downshift from that school mode. But when you're home 24/7, you don't really ever have that, like, physical reminder that, like, I am now at home. I am not at work.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Protests are happening around the country following the May 25th death of George Floyd, a Black man who died when a Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his neck for almost 9 minutes. In Milwaukee, people have held protests since last Friday over Floyd's death and the ongoing problems of police brutality and racial injustice. Yesterday's protests in Milwaukee started at Humboldt Park in Bayview and made its way downtown. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with protesters about why it is important for them to take a stand and what they are demanding.
I'm Jalen Phillips. It's been a lot going on with police brutality and racism in general. We never got justice for anything. They say a change is going to come, but we never see it. So we got to start somewhere. It starts now. The body cams, isn't doing anything. It's still happening. The police chief, the president need to say something directly. They're not stopping this. I don't see no change from the beginning of time. It's still happening, and it's not gonna stop until we have the full support of the whole country, you know?
Hi, I'm Hendrix Dawson. I'm 10 years old. I go to school in the downtown Milwaukee area. These police need to stop killing fellow Black people. It's kind of sad. I mean, we should all be treated equally. We shouldn't be, you know, killing other people who are different race and colors and stuff. It's dangerous, and it's kind of heartbreaking.
Hi, I'm Rob Smith. Man, this is the moment, you know, and you want to be part of the moment. You want to stay safe, but I'm out here with the people. My complaints are obviously about unchecked police violence, police violence generally. My concern is associated with a president who's escalating violence, using his power to mobilize our various branches of the military and the threats associated with that. I'm here because this is a tipping point in our country, and if we don't hold true to democracy in this moment, our nation will fall asunder. My demands are that we reallocate funding from a heavily militarized police force to other social mechanisms to improve our society where the money should be going. My demands are that we stay true to the basic fundamentals of our Constitution in this moment. And my demands are that we bring an end to blatant and hostile white nationalism.
Hi, I'm Henderson Smith. I'm 12. I'm here because I don't think it's fair that I have to be scared when I go outside. So I'm just here to see the people out here walking and protesting for Black rights. It makes me feel good to see that it's not just African Americans or minorities coming out to support our rights. It's a whole diverse group. So that makes me feel really good. My demands are to fix the system because it's not right. So my demands are to give more funding for public schools so we can learn more about our history, and just teach people to know how to talk to a cop and for cops to interact with minorities in general in a better way than what they do now. My dad's a history professor in these type of areas, so I'm growing up knowing my rights and growing up knowing what I should and shouldn't have growing up. Those things are equal rights. Since I was born here, which amendment is that? The 12th? Is that the 12th
amendment? 14th amendment.
The 14th amendment states that if you're born in the U.S., you have all rights of a U.S. citizen. So I should have my rights, and I don't want to feel violated or be violated.
Hi, my name is Sinovia.
What we seen was evil. That was pure evil. To have a man's life under your knee, and him telling you I can't breathe. That's evil. I couldn't even imagine how hopeless you feeling hopeless. Like you really feel your life drained, like slipping away from you, and this man just won't get up off of you. And you tell him I can't breathe, and he doesn't care. That's evil. That he knew that man was gonna die. It's no way that man's under your knee, not breathing, and he's gonna survive. And each police officer there should be charged with some type of connection, because they were just there and they watched it happen. Like, if it was normal people, you know, and it was a normal murder and there was no badges, you know, everybody who was involved would have got charged, you know. But because they wear badges and have blue jackets, they get slapped on the wrist. Or all they got to do is find a new job, but they still get to live out here in society with their white privilege at that, while that man just dead and gone. And his kids and his grandkids got to live without him, and his wife got to live without him. And that's just, it's not right.
Taylor, I think from this protest, I want for these officers that have killed unarmed and unthreatening black people to be charged with first degree murder, because that is what it is. And any other verdict would be diminishing the situation in its entirety. As unfortunate as it is, our country does evolve around money, and I think a restructuring on how we fund our police departments, our prison system, and our education system is pretty central to undoing everything wrong that has been done already. The education system in this country is incredibly broken, and I think that's one thing that we could fix that would definitely, in future generations, have a different outcome. I think the way that we talk about race in schools from a young age doesn't foster an environment where people can feel included and heard. I definitely encourage people to look beyond just what's happening in front of your face and educate yourself on why it's happening and what systems have brought us to this point.
That was WUWM's Mayan Silver bringing us voices of some of the protesters who participated in yesterday's march that started in Bayview. To find more coverage of local protests, go to WUWM.com. Coming up next, we're joined by Reggie Jackson to learn about the history of Milwaukee's civil rights protests and the relationship between the city's police and our black community. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Hallelujah. To our God, glory, hallelujah.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee is no stranger to civil rights protests. The city's open housing marches have become the stuff of legend. For 200 consecutive nights, demonstrators marched from Milwaukee's predominantly black north side to the predominantly white south side. Now, Milwaukeeans have taken to the streets once again to protest police brutality. One of the goals protesters are trying to achieve is to change how police interact with communities of color. Despite a long history of civil rights movements, Reggie Jackson says this country has yet to see meaningful police reforms. Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum, an institution dedicated to remembering 400 years of violence and genocidal acts against black people in the U.S. Jackson joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the history of Milwaukee's civil rights protests and the relationship between the city's black community and its police.
Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Joy. Been a while, but good to see you again.
Yes, in a closet, of course, but... So, of course, a lot of our listeners will be familiar with your work as the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum. When we're talking about, you know, the Black Holocaust here in the United States, how do police forces fit into that overall picture?
Looking back at our history in this country, many people aren't familiar with the institution of police in this country actually came out of slave patrols. And the way the slave patrols worked for many centuries in this country, first Africans, of course, arrived here in the 1600s. And they would force white men, typically, to be part of these patrols to make sure that Africans stayed where they were supposed to be. And so this was this force from outside our community that we were dealing with on a daily basis that controlled our movements, controlled our activities. And it appears to us that it's always been the case. We've never had a good relationship with police during any of the years that we've been here. And so as we look at some of the things that have happened in terms of police brutality over the years, these are extensions of things that have happened. It's been a never-ending cycle of difficulties and violence from police that we've been dealing with.
In general, how would you characterize the relationship between police and our Black community here in Milwaukee?
I would say, for the most part, it's terrible. I think there's a great deal of distrust on both sides. There has never been a really good relationship between the Milwaukee Police Department and the Black community. I'm not all that old. I'm, 54 years old, but I can remember hearing stories about former police chief Harold Breyer. I can remember when I was in high school and this young Black man, Ernest Lacey, died in an encounter with the police. And I can't remember a time that I've lived here where there's ever been a good relationship between the Black community and police. And looking back at, when the Black community started to grow in larger numbers back in the 1940s, there were a lot of incidents of police brutality back at that time. There were Blacks killed by the police in the 50s and 60s. The case of Daniel Bell, who was shot to death by a police officer who lied about it for decades before his partner finally fessed up. So there's a long history in Milwaukee of the Black community not having a good relationship with the police, and multiple Black people have died in encounters with the police, many unarmed Blacks. And so it's just a continuation. In our eyes, it's really kind of business as usual.
You know, as you say, these are incidents that have been occurring since the 1940s. And since that time, what have demonstrations looked like?
You know, we've always protested when there have been these incidents. I was reading some stuff about the 1940s when the police were harassing Blacks in the old, Bronzeville business district. And a lot of youth in particular were being harassed by the police, and the Black community got together and they, they protested to city leaders about it. And then you go to the 1960s, cases of police brutality during that decade, and there were protests, peaceful protests throughout the Black community. We go to the Ernest Lacey event in 1981, the Coalition for Justice, the first Coalition for Justice in Milwaukee, we started. The founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum, Dr. James Cameron, was part of those protests. And then we just kind of continued to protest and protest. And in the end, nothing really changes. We protest and we hear city leaders say that changes will be made, reform is coming. And then we wait for the next time and we see that nothing has really changed at all.
Well, that gets to another question that I have about this. I think people will be at least a bit familiar with the photographs of demonstrations in the 1960s and the police response at that time. When we look at these previous movements, demonstrations, what has the police response looked like here in Milwaukee?
In many cases, the police have responded very poorly. There have been beatings of peaceful protesters, just as we're seeing now. The police don't like to be questioned about the way they do things. And typically, they respond in a pretty heavy-handed way. I don't think it's anything like what we're seeing right now. I think this is kind of unprecedented, when you're seeing these protests around the country, and particularly the fact that so many whites are involved in the protests. As I was looking at television last night, seeing that there are protests in London and Amsterdam, when I heard yesterday that people are protesting in the Amish community in this country, in Fargo, North Dakota, I think that white people who are protesting now are feeling the true wrath of the police response that is typically felt in the black community. And I think that it's quite a surprise to them.
I was reading your initial response to these demonstrations, and something you said was, quote, "Each time police kill black people, America reacts in similar ways." But as you said, you know, you're seeing more diversity among the people who are protesting. Still, it's hard not to make comparisons between what happened in light of the murder of Eric Garner, Dontre Hamilton, Laquan McDonald, among, unfortunately, many other examples. What do you think feels different about these demonstrations compared to what we saw previously in the last decade?
I think the biggest difference is just the accumulation of these cases. There's been so many over a number of years. And I think what really sets this one off as being really different is when people saw the video of George Floyd and heard him say the words that Eric Garner said back in 2014. That resonated with people. And then the most emotional part of that video is when he was calling for his deceased mother. That touches any human being. There's no way as a human being you can hear those words and see this man literally losing his life in front of you. I call it a snuff film. I can't watch it. I can't watch the video. I've read about it, but I can't watch it because I've seen too many of these. And I think those emotions that people got from hearing those words from him, I think is what took this over the top. It really touched your humanity. And as I'm looking at all of the people who are out protesting along with black people, it says a lot about how we have changed as a nation. I think that white people are beginning to finally listen and realize that the things we've been saying about police brutality are absolutely true. And, you know, what I was writing about in the article is that the responses are always the same. You know, the things that are happening always happen. You know, we hear people, elected officials and others say, you know, this is a tragedy, this is terrible. And then we're going to hear about, you know, we need more training for the police. And then there's going to be some commissions to look into it. And then in the end, there'll be no real reform. That's what I was talking about, because it plays out the same way. It's very predictable because it happens the same way. The only thing that's different this time is that the protests have been much more widespread. And I don't think that America was really ready for the protests to spread in the way that they did. I think it's come as quite of a shock to a lot of people. And then to see that it's spread now internationally, that says that a lot of people are paying close attention to what's happening here. And our response thus far has been terrible, in my opinion, particularly the response from Washington with President Trump has exacerbated the situation. He's really thrown fuel on the fire. And, you know, we don't know how long these protests are going to last, as long as we continue to exacerbate the situation instead of trying to bring calm to the situation. We're doing the exact opposite.
You know, a lot of people have been drawing comparisons between this moment that we're in right now and 1968. And something that I thought of immediately when this started to happen was one of our conversations about the Red Summer of 1919, in part because similarly they were dealing with a pandemic. They were still dealing with the Spanish flu. Do you yourself see these echoes of our past in our current movement? And, you know, both of these moments in time, they did lead to some real change.
You know, there are always ways you can look at current situations and find parallels in the past. Obviously, back at that time during World War I, we're dealing with the pandemic. We're dealing with all of those major race riots where whites are leaving their communities and brutalizing and killing blacks looting their homes, businesses, property, but we don't learn about those things in school. When we look at what happened in 1968 after Dr. King's assassination, you know, that assassination really ripped the heart out of the Black community. We were so distraught as a community, and even, you know, many whites who were, you know, followers of Dr. King were just distraught, and people didn't know what to do with their emotions. And so you saw the way that people reacted. I think the same things are happening now. And even when we look at, you know, the changes that take place after these things, they're never really significant changes, in my opinion, when it comes to the way that we police, because I'm writing a couple more articles. You know, one is looking at how we police and the fact that we have never really had any real reform in the way we police. We police the same now as we did 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago. There's been no real reform. You know, we talk about training, but training only goes so far. There has to be a fundamental shift in the way that police do what they do, because most people are completely unaware that over 1,000 Americans each year are killed in encounters with the police. That's an average of 3 per day, 1 every 8 hours. And there is something fundamentally flawed when every 8 hours an American will lose their life in an encounter with the police. And those are the changes that I want to see happen. I want to see big changes, fundamental changes that say, listen, there's something wrong with what we do. And I haven't heard any police departments make that announcement that there's something wrong with the way we do our job. You know, they'll say, well, you know, there's always some bad apples. It's not bad apples. It's the whole cart is flawed. There's something wrong with the cart the apples are in. And until they're willing to admit that they are too quick to use violence, that they recruit people from the military. And, you know, people come into police departments with a military mindset. When we send our military overseas, we typically send them over there to take people's lives. And if you have that mindset as a police officer, you are not going to be in a situation that's a peaceful situation, and it's going to end peacefully. There's no reason that a man who was accused of using a counterfeit $20 bill should have lost his life. There's no reason that Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes should have lost his life. There's no reason that Freddie Gray was tossed around in the back of a police vehicle and no one was held accountable. You know, these things are just absolutely ridiculous. And part of what really frustrates us is that, you know, the pace of how they handle it is very poor in our eyes. You know, if I was to kill someone, Joy, in front of my house, the police would arrest me on the spot and they'd investigate, you know, and all of these things. But what happens when police kill someone? They never arrest an officer right away. It's always days and weeks and even months before we have an arrest. Many times we don't even know the name of the police officer. And they always say the same thing, Joy. They always say this: oh, we have to make sure we do a thorough investigation and get this right, make sure we have the right charges. Listen, you can throw somebody in jail who's a police officer, the same as you would do a civilian, and investigate while they're sitting in the Milwaukee County Jail. There's no reason you can't have that officer in jail while you do your investigation. There's no reason you can't amend the charges, because they do it all the time. These excuses just don't work for us. And it is very frustrating when we have to wait weeks. You know, an officer chokes a man to death at a party at his house, and weeks pass before something happens to the officer, before he's charged. These things are exceptionally frustrating. And I've always advocated this when I've talked to police officers, including former Chief Flynn, that listen, until you start treating police officers who commit crimes the way you treat civilians who commit crime, you will never have the trust of the Black community and the Latino community in the city.
Yeah. Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for sharing so much of your voice in this conversation.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Joy, to talk with you. It's unfortunate that, you know, we're talking about some, you know, ugly stuff. But, you know, that's the life we live. And I'm happy to be able to inform your audience and, you know, just kind of give some perspective and historical background. Always appreciate the opportunity, Joy.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum and a member of the City of Milwaukee's Equal Rights Commission. He spoke with Lake Fextroy Powers, and you can find more conversations with Jackson at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we learn how the current recession and political tensions have made economic mobility harder than ever. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. According to the latest data from the Department of Labor, 1 in 4 working Americans have filed for unemployment benefits since the coronavirus pandemic began a couple of months ago. With the federal government directing bailouts to save America's corporations and looting now affecting companies' bottom lines, much attention has been placed on the responses of the ultra-wealthy. Anand Giridharadas is the host of Seat at the Table, a talk show from Vice News and New York Times bestselling author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He recorded this conversation with Lake Effect's Julian Haida shortly before the racial and economic unrest came to a head.
Anand Giridharadas, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's been a lot of news about what's the best way to fight this coronavirus? How are some of the ways that America's super wealthy have positioned themselves in relation to the fight against the coronavirus?
Well, to quote Audre Lorde, I mean, the best way to fight the coronavirus crisis is not with the tools that caused it. You know, I mean, tools both in the sense of instruments, you know, the institution, systems, ideas, but also tools in the more pejorative sense of people. Frankly, a lot of what we are seeing in this crisis is the billionaire class stepping in and saying, you know, we can help, we can do it. In fact, there's a bit of like, only we can do it. You're seeing officials like Governor Cuomo appoint billionaires to these commissions to reinvent the New York economy, reinvent education, this and that. You're seeing billionaires like Bill Gates step up and launch their own initiatives around vaccines and other things. You're seeing talk around the Giving Pledge and getting more people to do that. You're seeing Jack Dorsey giving money away. You're seeing companies like Blackstone, Wall Street, big powerhouse Wall Street firm, donating to first responders, making a big show of it. And what a lot of that obscures is the ways in which that same billionaire class is responsible for the way in which this crisis has unfolded in America. Now, to be 100% clear, this is a virus that originated elsewhere and came to this country. And I don't, you know, attribute the birth of this, novel coronavirus to the billionaires.
And it's very easy to do that right now. I think some people are insinuating that that's the gist of a lot of conspiracy theories.
Right. That's not the right conspiracy. You know, that there's a reason that that's a conspiracy theory. There's a real conspiracy that's in the light of day, that we don't need to speculate about why it is that when this virus hit our country, the way it hit so many, it unfolded in the way it did here, right? And that's when you need to start asking, why do we not have South Korea's outcome? Why do we not have Germany's outcome? Why do we not have various other, China's outcome? And that's the answer inevitably is the system that we have, the systems, the quality of government, the effectiveness of government, the ability to act early versus late, to listen to science, to have pandemic prevention teams that are actually funded rather than defunded, all of those things. And when you then ask, why did the follow-on consequences of this pandemic happen the way they have? This many people unemployed, that was not inevitable either. Just if you look at a virus under a microscope, you can't predict how many unemployed people that's going to cause in a society. That's a product of social choices, not of the virus. Societies that decide to nationalize salaries, as they've been calling it, have had very different outcomes than societies that haven't. So we've made a bunch of social choices in this country over the last generation that have caused the pandemic to have the outsized impact it has on us. And the question then becomes, who made the choices, who pushed for the society to adopt those particular positions, to not have universal health care, to defund pandemic prevention? Who decided it was more important to let people be billionaires before we solve the problem of allowing most people to have, you know, the rudiments of a decent life and enough savings to withstand a minor shock? And the answer is the billionaire class, the same very class of people, and in some cases, the same exact people who are stepping up right now, who are giving back, who are in the papers every day, donating to things. That same class of people have been avoiding taxes and fighting for tax laws that cost the society resources and keep them rich. They have been lobbying for bottle service public policy that defangs and defunds government and keeps them wealthy and powerful. And they have been pushing in the corporate sector for manufacturing practices, corporate practices, outsourcing practices, where every nickel possible was saved. And that meant moving any production you could to China. That meant employing as few people as possible as employees and putting as many people on contract and in the precariat as possible. And so we end up with what you know in Wisconsin and what we know around the country, which is a society that was hyper vulnerable to this virus, more vulnerable than most. We are number one, Wisconsin. We are number one, America. We are number one.
And very quick to reopen at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, what you're getting at here is like a kind of state capture where there's like a give and take between private interests and state interests. You know, here in Wisconsin, you see Amazon getting, you know, tens of millions of dollars of tax credits, Foxconn building on Lake Michigan. And the state is actively working with them. The state feels like they need to compete with other states to raise private capital. So how does that begin to pivot? How does the government then begin to serve the people who live in the areas around that Amazon fulfillment plant and protect their, you know, their rights as citizens of Wisconsin and the United States, or protect people who live next to a Foxconn factory from pollution? What are the ways that people can get the government to serve them as opposed to those interests in competing with other states?
Well, I think there's a philosophical answer and there's a practical and structural answer. The philosophical answer is this notion of neoliberalism, which your listeners may have heard bandied about, you know, that was very much has been the dominant ideology in this country and in many other countries the last 40 years, is the notion that the best kind of government is the government that unleashes entrepreneurs and business people to do them. And that human flourishing will flow from helping business, be great, and grow. And the nice thing about a theory like that is you can try it. We've tried it. Turns out not to be true. Leaving businesses alone is a really good strategy for making businesses bigger. So that's useful information. We know that. It turns out it's not particularly useful for human flourishing. And the best thing to do for human flourishing is to actually work to, you know, foster it. Educating people actually helps human flourishing. Cutting education to be able to cut corporate taxes, actually not that good for human flourishing. Building roads, great for human flourishing. You know, having potholes in all your roads because you want to give companies the chance to hide their money in the Caribbean, not as great for human flourishing. So philosophically, the answer to your question is we need to bury neoliberalism, especially in places like Wisconsin, where, frankly, a very large number of people have been hurt by the ravages of the last 40 years, and yet believe in the ideology that has hurt them. There's probably folks listening to this who kind of at least softly believe that, you know, free market is best, entrepreneurs are the true heroes, government's kind of wasteful and bloated, government just the DMV. And if you believe that, you are believing a story that is a Koch brothers narrative that has been jammed into every corner of the American mind. There needs to be uprooted from that.
Well, people see themselves in that, right? They want to be the next billionaire. I think of the Steinbeck quote that they're just temporarily embarrassed millionaires. So, like, you know, they wanna feel like they can be the next Bezos. But you're saying that's not necessarily accessible to most people.
Breaking news right here on NPR. If you're listening to this, you're probably not going to become a billionaire. Not because you're listening.
Not me, at least.
Listening to this has no effect on your chances. You just had no chances of being a billionaire before this, and you certainly don't have any chances of being one after. The only thing I'm going to do is make you feel slightly better about that reality. And yet, if you vote for the kinds of policies that allow billionaires to treat the country like a, you know, kind of private lounge, you're just screwing yourself out of some completely unrealistic feeling that you're going to be one of them one day. And the structural part of that, if we can move beyond the philosophy of unleashing business is what's best for all of us, there's a more practical answer of corruption. The reason, you know, government in Wisconsin and elsewhere serves the interests of companies, not people, is because they take money from companies. And we now live in this post-Citizens United world where that is considered, you know, speech, considered a fundamental freedom of a corporation, which apparently is a person. In fact, some of the most important people we have are corporations, apparently. And if we don't take money out of our politics, let's be very clear, no one listening to this, like, your vote cannot meaningfully matter in a world in which companies can overrule you on every issue. So making sure we eradicate money in American politics, which is the norm in most rich countries, is crucial to any kind of recovery of decency and, frankly, building a kind of future that will work for everybody.
If you're just joining us, listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR, I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Anand Giridharadas. He is the host of Seat at the Table on Vice and author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Now, you mentioned this term that I think activists might throw around or might be, you know, exist a lot in the academy. You explained what it is, neoliberalism, this ideology that exists and is very pervasive in America. And I think people in America especially like to prescribe ideologies to political parties. Now, the DNC is scheduled, planned to at least be based in Milwaukee this summer. And at the last DNC in 2016, they seemed to borrow a little bit of language from Bernie Sanders. They said, you know, equality is not going to happen with the 1%. Do you see the Democratic Party moving away from a history of neoliberalism in this country any more than they did in 2016? Or are your hopes kind of shot given that, you know, more wealth is being accrued in a certain class?
Until we see evidence that the Democratic Party has actually meaningfully changed and ceased to be a party of money, it is a party of money. It's a party funded by and beholden to rich people who are, you know, better than the rich people on the right. It's like tolerant rich people. It's rich people who don't hate gay people. It's rich people who don't hate immigrants. It's rich people who like the environment. So that's good. Sort of like the slightly woker rich people. But the Democratic Party is very much the party of woke rich people, not the party of people. So I think it's really, really important for the Democratic Party to have some kind of existential reckoning. What we learned from the Warren and Sanders campaigns is, A, they both ended up falling short, and so there is a limited constituency for what they were offering, not enough to win, but frankly, a big enough constituency that the Democratic Party should consider itself on notice, that it is not connecting with a tremendous number of people who fundamentally think it's rotten and corrupt. And, you know, if your voters feel that way about you, a substantial number of them, you have a problem, and they're probably not wrong.
Now, you mention woke wealthy people, and earlier you mentioned the Giving Pledge at the very beginning of our conversation. And this seems to be the kind of wealthy people, the kind of coastal wealthy people, whether it be, you know, Bill Gates, who are saying they're going to donate a lion's share of their wealth to a charitable cause. We don't know what that cause is supposed to be. And a lot of people have signed this pledge, albeit it's only one in six American billionaires, and very few Wisconsin billionaires have signed the Giving Pledge. It's just one, Judy Faulkner of Epic Systems, not the Menards, not the Kohlers, not the Johnsons, not the Cargills. So how much is that pressure to be a woke, wealthy person? The kind of person who is able to thread that needle like Jeff Bezos tries to do, or like Bill Gates tries to do, and culturally where you are in the country, who do you appeal to? What's your take on that?
Look, you know, the seed for the book Winners Take All was this paradox that you are getting at, which is, on the one hand, we're living in this golden age of philanthropy. It sounds like Wisconsin may be a little behind on that one, so you know, that may or may not be a good thing. But we're living in this age in which the billionaire class is giving away more than has ever been given away, and young people, you know, all determined to go start a social enterprise in some poor country and save the world. All that's great. And yet, the stubborn facts of the age are that this is the most unequal period in America in a century, that we are seeing every day a collapse of the American mobility structure. And I began to wonder, is it possible that we have this inequity precisely because of how these very rich people use their do-gooding to prop up a system that they don't want to change? And they give just enough and get just enough reputational benefit from it and buy just enough influence from it that they're able to keep the system. They're, in other words, willing to give anything they possibly can except to concede that the system that allows them to make this much money and leaves most people behind. And what I really hope comes out of the pandemic is that the truth of how this society works and for whom it works will be revealed so starkly, so clearly, that we will actually have the opportunity to build another America on the other side of it. It's hard to overstate how grim this period is, and just the sheer amount of death, too much death to fit in the obituary pages that we have, more death than can fit in our newspapers. But it is also the case that after tragic episodes in history like this, there is often a moment of social resetting that you don't get in normal times. There's a moment where there is a space for people to admit they were wrong. There's a moment where people can change their minds, new coalitions become possible. And if we play this right, the pandemic is going to clear a lot of the brush of BS that was coming between us and real change.
Yeah, we'll see how this goes. Thanks so much for joining us, Anand.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anand Giridharadas is the host of Seat at the Table, a talk show from Vice News, and New York Times bestselling author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He spoke with LakeFX's Julian Haida in May. Coming up next, we hear from education reporter Emily Files about what people's new normal is for school. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus has disrupted the education world to an unprecedented degree. WUWM education reporter Emily Files put out a call to the people who have been directly affected by the school closures and the unplanned shift to online learning. Teachers, students, and parents sent Emily voice memos and emails describing their new normal. Today, we'll hear some of their voices. To start, here's Emily.
We'll start with Lori Horn. She's a longtime middle school science teacher in Brookfield. Here's part of the voice memo she sent us.
I go through periods of highs and lows where one day I feel like I've got this and I'm on top of it and things are going well. And the next day it's overwhelming and the pace is too much and I just want to crawl in bed and sleep.
Lori's school pivoted to online learning in March, and she says it's been hard to adapt her hands-on classes.
Normally, I would have access to microscopes and skeletons and all sorts of other things that would make hands-on learning more vibrant.
in the classroom, and those things are not accessible to my students right now, and I'm finding that to be a challenge.
When I called Lori to talk more, she said another challenge has been establishing boundaries between work and personal time. When a student texts her at 10 p.m., she feels obligated to respond.
You know, home is usually your respite away from school. Like, you come home and you kind of have some downtime, and it's like you downshift from that school mode. But when you're home 24/7, you don't really ever have that like physical reminder that like, I am now at home, I am not at work. And it's hard to like shut it off, I guess.
There are a lot of factors causing anxiety for educators right now. Willie Williams is worried about how the school shutdowns will widen the achievement gap for his students and how their mental health will be affected. Willie is the middle school dean at Carmen Northwest, a charter school in Milwaukee that enrolls predominantly Black students from low-income families.
My biggest question and my biggest concern is, when will we be able to go back to the school, we'll be able to go back to our classrooms and just get the ball rolling again. We know that there is an educational gap between Black and Brown students in Milwaukee, and we just don't want to waste any more time.
Willie's job is focused on building a positive school culture. He says it's a hard thing to do when school is online. If that continues in the fall...
It's not something that I'm looking forward to, because I really enjoy being around scholars, and that's the reason why I got into education. It was to teach and have interactions and have relationships with kids, and it's very difficult now to have those same relationships.
On the other side of the screen, families are coping with losing the structure and respite schools provide.
The first couple weeks were probably the hardest.
Amy Allman is a registered nurse who lives in Greendale with her husband and her 16-year-old son, Lucas, who has special needs.
I mean, he understands on the one level, he understands why he can't go to school, and he'll say, you know, I don't want to catch the coronavirus. So the first week or two, it was like almost every day he had a little meltdown about something. You know, it'd be the end of the day, he's tired, he's hungry, he wants to find a specific toy or a book or a Pokemon card or something, and he can't find it, and then he'll just all of a sudden lose it, you know, and just be like crying and screaming and throwing things. And then we quickly learned, okay, this is just his way of kind of getting that anxiety out.
Amy and her husband have been working throughout the school closure. They rotate days at home. When she is home, Amy sits with her son and helps him through his online assignments.
You know, it really is a full-time job in a way. You know, I've had friends who are on Facebook and, you know, they're not essential workers, or they've, you know, been sort of stay-at-home moms anyway. And they're, oh, I've taken up this hobby during the safer at home, and I just made sourdough, and I'm now making pretzels and crackers. What are you doing with your quarantine time? And I feel like, honey, I can't even get my bathrooms cleaned. Okay. So yeah, Amy's not cooking bread today. So it's certainly a different experience, I think. You know, everybody's been affected very differently.
Nat DeVauer's family has had a very different experience over the last couple months. Instead of hunkering down in their Shorewood home, they've been staying at his family farm in Fall River, north of Madison. They've rejected online school altogether.
We have transitioned to living at the farm where I grew up and focusing on the childhood I had with more of a free learning situation. And with this has come, we have sort of ignored some of the virtual learning instruction coming from Lake Bluff School, much to the chagrin maybe of the teachers, who I understand and empathize for.
When we talked a couple weeks after he sent that voice memo, Nat said the teachers are ultimately understanding about his family's decision to stay on the farm and forego virtual learning. Nat says he's happy his four elementary-aged kids are getting a taste of what he experienced growing up surrounded by nature.
We did go get some chickens on Craigslist. So one of the real highlights for them has been caring for these chickens every day, going down and getting the eggs. You know, and then we kind of make the eggs for breakfast. They named all the chickens. Just that hands-on experience is clearly kids respond to that.
Nat is wary of too much screen time for his kids, and he says if schools stay online in the fall, they'll probably homeschool. College students are weighing similar decisions about the future. Rowan Hawthorne was in the last half of her sophomore year at University of Vermont when the pandemic hit. She came back home to Hartford, Wisconsin.
I miss my walk to class from my dorm every morning a lot because I would see the mountains every morning, at 8 or 8:30, and it would always be beautiful, whether it was, rainy or sunny. I miss that so much.
A couple weeks after Rowan's classes shifted online, she says she woke up and felt a complete lack of motivation.
I just had such little energy to do that, and I knew I had a bunch of assignments, and instead I played the guitar, or I did some art, or I read, or, spent a lot of time procrastinating on my phone instead. And it was just, I'm typically a pretty good student, and so it was hard for me to see myself go to that, but I couldn't figure out how to get out of that either, because it just, school wasn't as valuable to me at that point in time. I didn't see as much of a point of doing it if I were doing it online.
Rowan says if University of Vermont stays virtual in the fall, she'll take a semester off. That's a big question for colleges and K-12 schools. If the virus keeps people at home, how many will opt out of digital learning? And if schools do reopen, middle school science teacher Lori Horn envisions a logistical nightmare.
I worry too that, people are like, oh, just push your desks apart farther. My desks don't move because I have lab station tables. So the only way to space kids out would be to have every other seat filled. And that would mean instead of having, 30 kids, I'd be at 15, and I don't think that's going to happen. So just a lot of questions.
Greendale parent Amy Allman says she's trying not to dwell on the unknown about what next school year will look like.
What can you do? These are things I can't control. I really don't think that school is going to start in the fall the way it used to. I don't think that they're going to be able to go back full time. My husband and I are kind of preparing ourselves for that eventuality.
Over the next month or so, large school systems like Milwaukee Public Schools and University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee are set to announce their plans for fall. Meanwhile, the coronavirus is keeping students, parents, and teachers in limbo, wondering how long this new normal will last.
That was WUWM education reporter Emily Files, bringing us perspectives from teachers and families affected by school shutdowns. You can see more of Emily's education coverage at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Like Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.